You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Jay Carlisle Larson.
And I'm Chris Molina. Coming up, if you want to know the time and temperature, you could look online, but what's the fun in that? We'll meet the guy behind the long-running phone service and why it's still going strong in the age of smartphones, tablets, and the internet.
First, power has been restored to more than 20,000 homes and businesses across the state, but at least 7,000 are still without power after another round of severe weather hit Wisconsin last night.
Governor Scott Walker has declared a statewide state of emergency, saying in a release today that the administration is ready to provide resources to all of the affected communities.
And nearly 500 passengers that were stuck on two Amtrak trains for nearly 24 hours because of the flooding have finally started traveling home to their destinations.
With us now to talk about all of this weather news is Marcia Krantz. She's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. Marcia, thanks so much for joining us.
Hi, thank you.
So the latest news here is that Governor Scott Walker has declared a statewide state of emergency for Wisconsin. How unusual is it from a weather perspective to have this statewide state of emergency declared because of a weather event?
I can't imagine it's a very normal occurrence just to have the whole statewide possibility impacted. So that's a pretty big thing.
Talk about some of the hardest hit areas from the storm last night and what weather conditions were like.
Last night, thunderstorms rolled from basically Mauston all the way east through Fond du Lac and Sheboygan during the afternoon hours. And that produced straight line winds with lots of tree damage, power line damage, and then also brief tornadoes spun up right along that line. So there were multiple reports of tornadoes just from one large storm system.
Yeah, and was this one really large storm cell, or was it a combination of storms that just kind of happened to come together?
Well, it was a cluster of thunderstorms that formed into a line. And then we had just the right conditions so that tornadoes would be able to briefly spin up in just the right spot along the lines. So that's how it goes sometimes, and we had the right environmental conditions. We were expecting this to be a problem. It's just you have to watch the storms as they go about and then issue warnings as necessary.
And I want to confirm, too, we had been hearing, reports of tornadoes, things that looked like possible tornado damage. Has it been confirmed now that tornadoes did touch down in some of these areas that you mentioned?
There were tornadoes, and the only confirmation point that we have at the moment is an EF1 near the Brandon area, and that is in far southwest Fond du Lac County. I know that the storm damage surveys are still ongoing. There's a lot of trees and structural damage to take a look at, and so the ratings are still happening. And so it's not that there weren't multiple tornadoes, because there definitely were. We just don't have the exact track and strength of every one of them laid out quite yet.
And Dane County had a particular interest in the weather of this week. Much of Dane County, western Dane County, the area around Madison, Cross Plains, Black Earth, still reeling from some flooding from last week. How did Dane County fare after the storms yesterday?
Yeah, Dane County had just under an inch, so about 3/4 of an inch of rain last night. They got pretty lucky. Areas to the north, from Fond du Lac to Montello to Mauston, had anywhere from 1.5 to 2.5 inches.
We are talking right now with Marcia Krantz. She's a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Milwaukee. And for a lot of the states, Marcia, the skies are looking pretty clear today. The sun is out. We may go a couple of days without rain. We might think, okay, the flooding risk is over. But for some areas, it sounds like there's going to be an increased flooding risk. Can you talk about what some communities might be looking at in the coming days?
Well, yes, I mean, everyone is very sensitive to any additional rain. Within the past 2 weeks, areas toward central Wisconsin, like from Toma, Mauston, Montello, Fond du Lac, even to Ozaukee, have seen 10 to 15 inches of rain. And even western Dane County saw those 15 to 19 inches in a 24-hour period. That was a couple weeks ago, but everyone is very sensitive to any additional rain. We will be dry Thursday, and then our next chance for showers and thunderstorms is Thursday night. And we do have another better chance for showers and thunderstorms again Friday night into Saturday. So we are watching for the potential for another, say, inch of rain. And again, everyone's just sensitive to any additional rain. It's going to take a little while for the rivers to come down out of their flood stages. So everyone is watching.
I tend to think of August as being one of the drier months of the year, the time of the year where grass is looking pretty brown. Not this August, it's sounding like. In terms of rainfall levels, are we getting near record levels for an August?
You know, I would imagine we are getting toward those record levels for August. It is one of the wetter Augusts, as you were saying. This of course is higher, but I'm not sure how close we are to that record.
And as we go forward here, do we know anything, long-term predictions about, whether we're going to see, I'm coming at this from someone who is obviously not a meteorologist, but does this tell us anything about what kind of weather or what kind of forecast we might be seeing in the fall and into the winter as well?
I think the winter is going to be a little bit milder. And I can tell you, like, even next week might actually be a little wetter. I'm better at the 7-day forecast than our seasonal forecast here, but we are looking at more of an active weather pattern for next year. Next week. However, we do have El Nino conditions on the horizon, and so that could give us a little milder conditions this winter.
And we're going to have to leave it there. Marcia, thanks so much for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Marcia Krantz is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service in Milwaukee, and she was with us to talk about the round of severe storms that came through the state last night and caused some serious problems. Think back to when you were a kid. Did you ever make a phone call to hear a recorded voice tell you the time and temperature?
Nearly 80 years after it started, people throughout the country and here in Wisconsin still rely on a call-in service to find out the time and the weather. Here's what you would have heard if you called it earlier today.
Today is Wednesday, August 29th. The current time, 12:46 p.m., and the temperature, 65 degrees.
According to our guests, the service got 60,000 calls to its Wisconsin numbers this past June alone. About a third of those went to the Milwaukee numbers, and in the past 4 years, the Milwaukee service racked up 735,000 calls.
John Lockridge is a telephone engineer for the Dallas-based ComSierre Solutions Group, LLC, and the man behind the time and temperature phone service. John, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, thank you. It's great to be here.
So for many of us who probably took the time as kids to take up the phone time and call this, some of us kind of forgot that it was still out there. But why do you see this still in demand today?
Well, it's part of a lot of people's childhood. I actually look at sometimes the postings on Facebook to get an idea because people rather get very excited about it. It's kind of fun having a job that makes so many people happy and makes their day. One person recently wrote on Facebook, it kind of perhaps tongue in cheek, I don't know. She said, "Well, the time and temperature is working. All is well with the world." And I kind of wish I could fix all that's wrong with the world with just putting back up time and temperature. But it sure is a whole lot of fun making people's day. And to quote one person that she wrote, she compared her old time number to a little slice of Mayberry. And so it's something that that harkens back to our childhood. I mean, it's the number that mom would let us dial when we were kids.
Yeah.
You know, it's like, can I use the phone? I want to use the phone. And mom's like, well, don't bug grandma. Well, I just want to call the time and temperature. Oh, well, that's okay, you know. So that's a little bit about it. And people write about other things, too, you know, so that they like. I mean, we actually do commercial ads to pay for it during the week. But on the weekends, I do some words from the scriptures and to encourage people and give them hope for the future on Sunday. So you may not have known that. So, and people like that, too. So it's kind of meaningful in multiple ways.
And so you said that someone said this was like a slice of Mayberry. And, you know, this service is, it's not new. It's been around since 1940. What was the purpose back then? How did it get started?
Well, back then, you know, you really had to know everybody needed to set their clocks. I mean, nothing's kind of more relevant than what time it is and, you know, what's the weather like, how hot is it, how cold is it. You know, 100 years ago, most people didn't have dials on their phones. They would crank the phone and speak to the operator. And, you know, Central Time, the name of your show, is kind of a reference in historically to the fact that we standardize our time zones. And the railroads pushed that. So they would get the time from railroad time from Western Union and all that. Well, the phone company really didn't like providing this service because it tied up the operators. and they didn't get paid for that. And so they actually, a gentleman who was created the original machine to do this was a marketing guy for a TikTok lemonade coming out of the Prohibition. And he built these giant clocks on billboards, and people would set their clocks by it. And he was an inventor, and he came up with the original equipment that was used to do this, which when the Bell system saw this, they're like, oh, this is a solution to our problem, tying up the operators. We're going to roll this out across the country. And so by 1940, these were in place all over the country. And so that's kind of the transition, how they went from asking the operator to a machine telling you the time and temperature.
We are talking to John Lockridge right now. He is a telephone engineer for the Dallas-based Concierge Solution Group, LLC, talking about what was a staple in many people's childhoods, being able to call a number and get the time and the date and the weather. So there are 42 numbers for this service across the state. And here in Wisconsin, in both small towns and bigger cities, you sent us some of the stats in terms of call volume in those areas. And one that jumped out was that in a town just south of Wausau, its population of about 4,000, it had 5,600 calls in June with the only one with more calls than people. Any idea why this service would be so popular in, you know, a little bit of a smaller town?
It is interesting. I mean, that one used to be operated by Mosinee Telephone years ago before they discontinued it. And some small towns, it's kind of fun. They actually get more calls than people, and it's just more popular in some places like that. And I don't really know why the difference is for that. It's just some areas it is more popular, some areas of the country it's more popular, and so the specific reasons I'm not sure about, but it is kind of interesting. Wisconsin is different from the rest of the country in that most of the areas of the state that the time was operated was provided by the telephone company, so it would have been Wisconsin Telephone or Wisconsin Bell or what became Century Tel, or in this case, a small phone company, independent phone company, Mosinee. In other parts of the country, would often be provided by a bank or some other institution, like it was down in Texas, where I'm from. Also on Central Time, I'm a big fan of Central Time, and so spent most of my life in Central Time, so I have a lot of good things to say about that. But it is really interesting. It is fascinating, you know, what the regional differences are. And AT&T actually discontinued the service in 2007, so it had been down 7 years before I started putting them back up. And they had done that pretty much across the country, the old Wisconsin Bell number. So that's a little bit of history. You know, it takes some effort to maintain these machines, and there's always a concern if you have one of the older equipment, you know, are we going to be able to support this going into the future? And that leads into the decision of them discontinuing them. So that's part of the reason why they go away.
So last week you launched service in Oklahoma City. How do you decide which areas you're, you know, going to serve with this?
Well, it's kind of a what comes to my attention. And in this case, I actually had some old-time numbers in Oklahoma City, but it wasn't the main one. It was an old weather number and one that had been operated by the OU Medical Center for many years, and their equipment had stopped keeping the correct time and had stopped keeping the correct temperature, and they made the very rational decision to say, well, we can't just leave this up and give people the wrong information. So they actually discontinued it about 3 weeks ago. But I reached out and said, hey, you know, I'd love to put this back up. We're even going to put up a weather forecast. And they signed off on that idea. And so as of last week, we've got it back in service. And it's nice. You know, people are still calling, and it's meaningful. I mean, blind people use this, elderly people mostly, but it's kind of fun. And they thought it was a great idea.
So as technology continues to become more and more innovative, we've been talking about smartphones today. In the last 30 seconds to a minute, how long do you see this phone service being around for people?
I think it will continue in some form for more than the next decade. You know, nothing's easier than a phone call, and you can't really install an app very well on your landline.
True.
Many people say, you know, it's just, you know, I think it's going to be around, obviously in fewer numbers calling, but I think we're here for the long haul.
Well, John, good luck with that. I wish we could talk to you a little bit longer, but thank you so much for joining us today.
Well, thank you for having me on the show. Take care.
John Lockridge is a telephone engineer for the Dallas-based Concierge Solutions Group, LLC. We talked to him about the phone service that he runs that provides the time and temperature that people throughout the country and Wisconsin still rely on today.
There are two kinds of road trips. One where your arrival time at your destination is not flexible. And then there's the other, arguably more fun trip. And that's the one where someone points out the window at something quirky off the side of the highway. And before you know it, you're turning the wheel to take the next exit to see it.
Our next guest is definitely a fan of the last scenario. He's written lots of books about Minnesotan and Midwestern culture, including a few that focus on something very road trip friendly, roadside attractions.
Here in Wisconsin, you could check out the world's largest talking loon in Mercer, or maybe visit Fred Smith's Concrete Park to see over 200 life-size figures in Phillips, Wisconsin.
You could also peer at the 55-ton boulder that landed in a house in 1995, now known as the Rock in the House, but that's not to be confused with the House on the Rock located in Fountain City.
It is hard to pick a favorite. Well, here to talk to us about these special landmarks is Eric Dregney. He's a professor of English, journalism, and Italian at Concordia University in St. Paul. He's the author of several books, including Midwest Marvels, Roadside Attractions Across Iowa, Minnesota, the Dakotas, and Wisconsin. And he was born in La Crosse, Wisconsin, home of the world's largest six-pack. Eric, thanks so much for joining us today.
Yeah, thanks. It's great to chat again.
Yeah, so one of the main reasons that we wanted to have you on here today, we had seen a recent piece in the New York Times in which the author was kind of reflecting on road trips that she had taken, and the title of the piece was Keep America's Roadside Weird. And I'm wondering, Eric, it sounds like that would be a sentiment that you agree with.
Exactly. I know there's all, you go on the interstate and then you get all of these, it's all just these box stores, and it's all the same. Whereas you get off on the secondary highways, and that's where you get all the great old roadside attractions. That, you know, there is, I almost think they should be put on the National Register of Historic Places, because they'll just disappear. You know, Wisconsin Dells, it changes every, you know, 10, 20 years, and completely a new makeover. We need to preserve these masterpieces of the roadside.
I'm glad that you brought up the Wisconsin Dells, because I was looking at your book, and your book came out in 2006, and one of the spots that you listed in the book was the Wonder Spot, and I started thinking about that today, and the last couple of times I've been to the Dells, I had not seen the ubiquitous signs, you know, that said, you know, 4 miles to the Wonder Spot, 3 miles to the Wonder Spot. And I found out that it closed some years ago because the land was sold to the city of Lake Delton. How in danger are these roadside attractions from disappearing from the landscape?
Well, especially one like that that relies on tourist money, completely reliant on it. And, you know, was Tommy Bartlett's Robot World still there? I don't know.
I think Robot World is gone now, but the ski show is still going strong, I think.
Okay. And then Xanadu, the Foam House of Tomorrow, is gone. You know, all those great ones. Yeah, Wisconsin Dells is a little unique because it relies on these tourists coming in, and if it doesn't work, they change it out to be something else. Sort of, you know, they have that giant Trojan there with a go-kart, and he used to be holding a giant hamburger, and now he's holding up a go-kart, and they have the Trojan horse in the background that's 60 feet tall. It's like, you know, a six-story building that you can drive your go-kart through. But who knows, you know, once that, you know, that could go by the wayside in some years. So how do we preserve these roadside attractions to keep it weird? Exactly.
So what is a roadside attraction in your eyes?
That's a good question. I mean, I think it's essentially people of the town. I mean, Wisconsin Dells is a little different because it's the whole town is kind of that way. But in the past, it's been, you know, something that they're trying to lure in tourists off the roadside. And oftentimes it's, you know, that they decide that we are the capital of, you know, like there's the world's largest penny in Wisconsin, you know, so they have all this copper or something that they want to show it off. And so they put all this together and the Lions Club comes together and they make this huge statue and everyone comes and it becomes the town symbol in a way. And then it's often, more often than not, it's the world's largest. But of course, who is saying that it's going to be the world's largest? I mean, there's no one. Is there any official place that decides this?
Well, I like the fact that there's some competition. I think I'd read something somewhere that someone had built the biggest brick wall or something, or it was supposed to be the biggest brick, but it was made up of like several different bricks. And then someone went and actually made like a really big, like one brick. So instead of, you know, like them changing their attraction, they just said, well, we're now like the biggest brick wall built of multiple bricks.
Yeah.
So
that's true. You like we have in Minnesota, we have the world's largest twine ball. That this guy spent, you know, 39 years of his life winding and gathering all this twine. Then when he went in the Guinness Book of Records, and, you know, Weird Al Yankovic wrote a song about it, but then people started copying it and made larger ones, of course. But then it kind of loses its thrill. So
I think a lot of us as kids remember going on road trips with the family and stopping at these roadside attractions. You know, as kids, we loved it. As parents, they were probably just happy to get the kids out of the car and subject them to what was likely a free attraction. But as adults, do you think we are less likely to maybe stop at these attractions? And if so, are we making a mistake?
You know, I think that as adults now, we look back on it nostalgically and think, like, oh, remember that time that we saw the, you know, the giant talking Paul Bunyan or the walk-through Muskie in Hayward? You know, and so you want to pass that on to your kids. Whereas the kids, I think nowadays, you know, they get so distracted. They're, you know, it used to be you have these endless road trips across Nebraska or wherever, and you have to have something to break up the monotony. But now they have all their little, you know, phones and other little players to keep themselves busy. So I don't know. I worry that we're going to lose this.
We are talking right now with Eric Dregney. He is a professor and an author. He is the author of Midwest Marvels, and we are talking about the Great American Roadside Attraction. And, Eric, you have written this book, Midwest Marvels. In terms of how the Midwest stacks up with the rest of the country, are we pretty good on the roadside attraction fronts?
Yeah. You know, I don't know what it is, but it's, I mean, obviously we have the Statue of Liberty, which I consider sort of in this genre, and then Mount Rushmore, which sort of, I know that they're, that's sort of sacrilege and people think that, you know, those are patriotic symbols, which they are, of course. But I mean, they are in a sense the same idea of making these just enormous statues, biggest. But here in the mid, I think out east, they tend to have things a little bit more cultured, a little bit more refined. Then you get people moving out here to the Midwest, and all of a sudden, you know, they decide, hey, I'm gonna do something big here. You know, you mentioned Fred Smith's Concrete Park. You know, he's got all these old bottles from his bar, so he starts making all these statues, and, you know, it's great. It just makes, it just gets to work, and I don't know that you find that much out east. Really, Wisconsin, Minnesota, I think we have more than anyone else, and then, you know, North Dakota has its fair share. I mean, down in Texas, there's some. You know, we have Carhenge out in Nebraska. But here, right in the upper Midwest, we have most of them, I think.
And behind every ball of twine or every huge statue, there is a person, as you sort of alluded to, who had this vision and who created this thing. And I think sometimes maybe we don't think so much about these people. We're so in awe of what we're seeing, we're not necessarily thinking about the people. And you've kind of heard some of their stories, and I'm wondering if maybe you could share one or two stories of the people behind an attraction that really stuck with you.
Yeah, you know, it's a lot of times it's sort of it's almost a vision from God, you know, like the Dickeyville Grotto, or, you know, you go down to the Grotto of the Redemption down in West Bend, Iowa, and, you know, people just dedicate their whole lives to building and building and building and building. And, you know, and sometimes it's just the civic project that they want to put together something really big. One of my favorites is in Sioux Falls, South Dakota. This rich benefactor wanted to bring some culture to South Dakota, so he dedicated this replica statue of David, Michelangelo's David, to the town. And so it scandalized the town, you know, having this giant, nude, beautiful specimen there. And so they started planting all these bushes around, and so then to cover him up, essentially. And that didn't really work. So then they turned him around, so now when people drive into town, it's like they're mooned by this giant statue of David. But it is, you know, someone has a vision for how they want to change their town and make it beautiful, put it on the map, really.
You know, I had seen something, a news story earlier this year. I believe it was a small town in Illinois. I can't remember the name off the top of my head, but there was a man who lived there, and he was a lifelong resident, and he was sort of sad to see businesses closing in his community, and he decided he wanted to do something about it. So he started building various, you know, world's largest objects for the businesses. So there was a knitting store in town, and he made the world's largest pair of knitting needles. There was a golf course in town. He made the world's largest golf tee. And it really seemed like this was his ticket to really improving his community. And that really seems like it speaks to what you're saying here.
Yeah, and strangely enough, that's kind of how it starts. Although sometimes you get people that they almost do it too intentionally, and then it backfires. Somehow it's, you know, it's just not quite as charming. You know, it's mostly when someone, you know, they like something like that. Like, you know, or it reminds me of this little town up in northern North Dakota before the oil boom. The town, like almost everybody left this town. So it was a ghost town. There are all these empty storefronts. So he started putting mannequins and people in this town. Like, there's the barber shop. So he recreated an old barber shop and recreated this and that with all these mannequins. So it was like this ghost town with all these mannequins. So super creepy at the same time. A little like in one of the big sites you have in Wisconsin is the House on the Rock. And the museum and all that stuff, you have that, I forget what it's called, but it's like this old time, like three-quarter size town and all of these old stores. It's like something like that, kind of this weird ghost town.
We're talking right now with Eric Dregney. He is an associate professor of English and journalism at Concordia University, St. Paul, and the author of Midwest Marvels. And we are talking about the roadside attractions in Wisconsin and across the nation.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you stop at these roadside attractions, and what draws you to them? What's your favorite attraction that you visited? Whether it's in Wisconsin or elsewhere in the country, give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We are picking up our conversation all about roadside attractions here in the Midwest and nationwide. Eric Dregney is with us. He's a professor at Concordia University in St. Paul and the author of Midwest Marvels, Roadside Attractions Across Iowa, Minnesota, the Dakotas, and Wisconsin.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What do you think of these roadside attractions? Do you stop and visit them? Do you go out of your way to see one? Or if you see that billboard on the side of the highway that says 200 miles to fill in the blank, do you go out of your way to check out these roadside attractions? And do you have a favorite one here in Wisconsin? Give us a call now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. And Eric, I think this is a topic that is resonating with people because we are having callers lining up. So let's hear what they have to say. Megan is with us in Madison. Hi, Megan.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
You bet. What did you want to say?
Well, I got so excited when you guys were talking about my favorite pastime. Anytime I make a road trip, and I love road trips, I make sure that I've got enough time to stop along the way. I definitely keep my eyes open for those brown signs that say historical marker or some interest and, you know, make a pit stop in that zone. Most recently, though, I was up with some friends driving up to Lafarge, Wisconsin for a music festival. We had passed through Richland Center, and they had known about the A.D. German warehouse there designed by Frank Lloyd Wright.
Hmm.
So on our way back, I made sure that we were able to get in for a tour. They do tours there from noon until 3 on Sundays. And then I realized we had a little bit more time before we had to be back in Madison. So we stopped in Arena, Wisconsin to Peck's Farmers Market and Petting Zoo. And they hadn't been there either, and I stop every time because I like to pet goats.
Who doesn't? Well, Megan, thank you so much for that call. And Eric, I love Megan's enthusiasm, and I love her willingness to find stuff. And I was also thinking you had mentioned the Dickeyville Grotto earlier in the interview, and that's one that I stumbled on a trip back from Potosi. I was driving through this town, and I literally slammed on my brakes, like, what is this building that's on the side of the road? And I'm wondering if the experience of finding these roadside attractions is almost a little bit better when they kind of sneak up on us.
Yeah, and it drives my wife crazy. I'm like, wait, we gotta stop, and she's starving, or, you know. Yeah, no, it's great when you drive along there. What is that thing, you know?
Yeah,
the Dickeyville Grotto. And now that you've seen the Dickeyville Grotto, you have to go all the way across Iowa to West Bend to see the Grotto of the Redemption, which is an entire city block of inspired by the Dickeyville Grotto. I mean, the Dickeyville Grotto is sort of the original here in the Midwest, but it inspired Fred Smith, inspired all these others to do it.
Megan, thank you so much for that call. Let's go next to Marshfield and talk to Chris. Hi, Chris.
Yes, I really do enjoy taking the kids on road trips and stopping by roadside attractions. Frequently, you know, sometimes you see the farmer that decides to create himself a zoo, or now a lot of pumpkin patches are expanding into a little bit more of a roadside attraction thing. But when I was a kid, we went up to Spooner on vacation every summer, and before 53 got turned into a four-lane, there was a scenic overwatch. Maybe it was a fire tower at one time or something, but I remember seemed like forever climbing up these steps and then looking out over the entire area, and they just had this little cable guardrail on the edge of the bluff, and just being so scared to look at the cable and look down at the scenery. And I've been trying to find that place for years now, and I have not been able to. Do you know where it is?
Chris, thank you so much for that call. Eric, is this anything that you've heard of?
I don't know about that one. I know about the big cowboy there in Spooner, and I know about the Jurassic Park there in Marshfield, but I don't know about this big lookout. We'll have to check it out.
You'll have to take a trip up to Spooner, Eric. And one of the other things that he brought up that I wanted to ask about, the fact that highways and changing highways might mess with this a little bit. And I think to like Route 66, which at its heyday, was just roadside attractions everywhere. And then the interstate system came in and sort of changed everything. Was that sort of, I don't want to say the beginning of the end for roadside attractions, but is that when we really started to see these places sort of going out of business?
Yeah, well, I think it marked a big change because, you know, Route 66, of course, is the classic. And, you know, they've sort of recreated a lot of those and the old motels and the teepee motels and things like that. And with the interstate system, I mean, you just zoom by things so fast with multi-lane highways. But, you know, when they connected the interstate, they met in Blue Earth, Minnesota. And that's when they brought, they actually, you know, how they had the Golden Spike for the railroad. they had a golden patch of cement there. And then they also erected at the same time the Jolly Green Giant, which is enormous. It's like 80 feet tall. It's huge. That was made in Sparta, Wisconsin. So it's sort of the Jolly Green Giant, in a sense, is sort of the golden spike there. But it's true, you know, that interstate, you just zoom by, whereas the old meandering little highways. But you still, if you get off those main interstates, you find these roadside attractions still there. And in a way, it's almost more classic when they're, you know, they're not quite kept up. They're not quite perfect. You know, that has a little bit of charm then.
We are talking right now with Eric Dregney. He is the author of Midwest Marvels, Roadside Attractions Across Iowa, Minnesota, the Dakotas, and Wisconsin. And we are talking about roadside attractions, the appeal, the Americana, all of that and more. And we're going to go back to your calls, and we're going to go to Mike in Sun Prairie next. Hi, Mike.
Hey, mention of Route 66. Are those TP things in Arizona still open?
Good question. I don't know for sure, but last I heard that they've fixed up a lot of those old ones and kind of kept, I mean, because they're tourists that go and run the whole thing, or, you know, someone gets an old 57 Chevy and they do it. So, yeah, I mean, now with the magic of Google, you can find that out.
And, Mike, I think you had one other place that you wanted to mention?
Yeah, on Route 66 in Springfield, Illinois, just down the street from Lincoln's Tomb, there's an old service station that was right, you know, one of the originals on Route 66. It's kind of cool to stop by if you're in the area.
Mike, thank you so much for the call. And Mike reminds me that I need to spend some more time on Route 66, because the last time I did some time on it, I found stuff that I didn't even know existed and was awesome. So that is a great point. Mike, thank you so much. I think we have time for one more call right now, and we'll go to John in Madison. Hi, John.
Hi. I wonder how many of your listeners have heard of the Forevertron out near Baraboo or Sauk City. Sauk City. That's my favorite roadside attraction. I did not hear of it because of the roadside sign. I heard of it word of mouth, actually. So I wonder if that can help revive the roadside attractions.
John, thank you so much for the call. And Eric, I know that the Forevertron is one that you've written about in your book with a lot of love. So talk to us about that one.
The Forevertron is amazing. I believe it is the world's largest old metal sculpture in the world at this point. Dr. Evermore, Tom Every, who built it, had also worked on the House on the Rock. He actually made the carousel there, that giant carousel. And then he works like in wreckage and, you know, getting all these old things. And it's just crazy. You got to stop. It's like this Victorian era, like cyberpunk thing, you know, steampunk vision of how like Jules Verne would send people to the moon or on. It's just incredible. I mean, I don't even know how to describe it. You begin describing the House on the Rock and you don't even know where to start, just because you just got to go see it.
Well, I could talk about roadside attractions all day long, but unfortunately we are out of time. Eric, thank you so much for joining us today.
All right. Yeah, thanks for having me on.
That was Eric Dregney. He's a professor of English, journalism, and Italian at Concordia University, St. Paul, and the author of Midwest Marvels. And he joined us to talk about why you might want to give roadside attractions near you a second glance.